My theme tonight is equanimity. Do we need a translation? Okay. The Pali word for equanimity is upekkha. That's one of them, there's two. So equanimity means composure, or this is a big word, imperturbability. So in other words, I'm so sorry. it means that which can't be shaken or blown over. So that which is rather steady. Another word, being unflappable. So it means not getting distressed. Okay? So it means to be in the middle of everything and be unwavering, be steady, have a sense of being composed, not stressed, not distressed. Evenness is sometimes another word that's used to describe it, or cool-headed, or even peace. And the felt sense of this, of course, so when we rest into equanimity, the felt sense is one of stillness and peace, or inner silence. So this is equanimity. In the text, the Buddha gives some other words to describe it, which I'll also need to change a little. He said, equanimity is abundant. In other words, there's plenty of it. It's not going to skip over you. There's lots of it. It's exalted. That means it's incredibly happy, very happy. If you're very happy, you're exalted. It's immeasurable. That means it's without limits. We cannot measure it. It's without end, without hostility, and without ill will. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? So sometimes equanimity is called the sixfold equanimity. And that's because we need to be steady with all the contact through the sense doors. So seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, and so on. We're rather steady with that which comes to the senses. And of course, what we've noticed over the days is dependent upon the contact through the sense doors is the Vedana, the feeling tone of experience, that which is pleasant, unpleasant, or in between. So we notice all of this, but we're rather steady with it. And whenever we're caught up in aversion or attachment, equanimity is lost. So to put it simply, if we know equanimity and we're resting into equanimity, the mind isn't pushed and pulled about. Consciousness isn't pushed and pulled about by our attractions, aversions, likes and dislikes. Christina Feldman, Dharma teacher and good friend of many years, says equanimity is not a future state or even an attainment, but a way of engaging with all that this present moment is revealing. That's rather beautiful. It's a way of being with this present moment as it's being revealed. So initially, the word upekkha was translated wrongly, actually, into English as indifference. So equanimity is not indifference. It doesn't mean that we cut off from everything or feel rather aloof or cool. It is not that at all. That's a mistake. That's an error. Sometimes we think indifference is equanimity. It isn't. In fact, indifference is known as the near enemy. It's known as something that we can mistake for equanimity. Bhikkhu Bodhi, one of the foremost translators of our time, says this about equanimity. He says, "It is evenness of mind, unshakable freedom of mind, a state of inner equipoise or balance that cannot be upset by gain and loss, honor and dishonor, praise and blame, pleasure and pain." He says, it is indifference only to the demands of the ego self, with its craving for pleasure and position, not to the well-being of one's fellow human beings. So far from being cold and uncaring, equanimity is accompanied by a natural radiance and warmth of being. So this is equanimity. And I'll give you a little example from my own life. It was some years ago now, about a decade ago. I was on my way to catch a plane in a little bit of a hurry. I was meeting some friends and planning to walk the Camino de Compostela in Spain. So I was leaving Australia. I dropped into the shop in Byron Bay to get something rather quickly. We have like a camping shop, or they're called disposal shops. Sometimes they have like ex-army gear that they sell rather cheaply in these shops. And so I was looking for a little solar light to take with me. We can get these little beautiful solar lamps that can fold down. And when I travel, not to here, but when I travel to India and if I'm camping, I take one with me. So I dropped into the shop to pick it up. As I was walking to the very back of the shop, I heard the voice of a man talking to the shop assistant, a woman. As I began to get a little closer, I instantly realized that the man had a mental illness. I could simply tell by the tone of his voice and the way he was talking. And so I'm a psychologist. I see these things rather easily sometimes. And my whole body kind of prickled with, wait a minute, but I was already there. It was too late. He was at the counter looking at knives to buy. And so displayed on this glass cabinet were about 6 knives. So he was looking at them, and the little shop assistant behind, she was just shooting me a look of help. What is this? The guy picked up a knife and thrust it towards me with the point right here at my chest, not in my skin, but in my clothes, and said, "Do you want this?" I don't know where this came from, but in that moment, I just turned to him, looked at him really kindly, and said in my most polite voice, "No, thank you." And he was so taken aback that he just put the knife down. So because I didn't react or scream or do anything or even jump, I don't think, because I just looked at him and said, "No, thank you," he just put it down. So then I bought my light and made sure the girl was okay, and I left. So this is equanimity. Sometimes the years of practice pay off. And somewhere within us, comes this sense of calm. I must confess, when I got back to my car, I had a few sensations run through my body. But everybody was okay. It's a happy ending story. So there's another Pali word that means equanimity as well. It's very long and I'll probably embarrass myself trying to say it, but it's my best shot at it is Tatra Majja Hatata. Well, something like that. So it's Tatra Majja Hatata. Something like that. It's very long. This word apparently means standing near to all things. So when we experience equanimity, we're standing near all things. So we're not ignoring something. We don't have equanimity to one or two things, but the totality of this life. So this is a challenge for us to stand and be and live in the midst of all things with steadiness. So we're asked to be steady with the painful and the difficult. We're asked to be steady with injustice. We're asked to be steady with our perceived failures and regrets. We're asked to be steady with inequality, racism. That's tough. It doesn't mean don't protest, by the way. But we're asked to be steady with. We're asked to be steady in the face of what we see in this world, the poverty, with our bodies, which through illness have limitations, or through aging have limitations. We are asked to be steady with all of this, and it's not easy. So it's a practice. So we're simply asked to be steady with the tragedy of the human condition. So equanimity is not a vast nothingness. It's not as if we just cover over everything either. Equanimity is actually a divine quality of the heart. And when we meet life in this way, we're engaged with life. We're amid the whole of life. And yet the equanimity and steadiness gives us a chance to respond with wisdom. We then can be rather responsive and free. Christina also says, equanimity is understanding what it means to stand in the midst of experience with unshakable balance, to be responsive yet unbroken. And I think this is very important because I know that many of you have faced very difficult situations in the past and continue to face them in the present. Here in Israel, this is particularly potent. So it's to be responsive yet unbroken. And here I'm going to read a poem about brokenness and unbrokenness. I hope you can follow. It's by Rashini, and it goes like this. There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken. A shatteredness out of which blooms the unshatterable, so that can't be broken. There is a sorrow beyond all grief which leads to joy, and a fragility out of which depth emerges strength. There is a hollow space too vast for words through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness we are sanctified into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound, whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to a place inside which is unbreakable and whole. So this is our deep knowing. The deep knowing of the part of our heart that can never be broken. The Buddha called this unshakable deliverance of mind. This is our goal in the teachings, to directly understand and know for ourselves unshakable deliverance of mind. So equanimity is profound peace. The knowing of silence, the knowing of stillness. Stillness with regard to our likes and dislikes, the pleasant and the unpleasant. In fact, the pleasant and the unpleasant comes first, and then the liking and the disliking, and the attraction and the aversion, and then, of course, the pushing away or moving towards or ignoring. So our immeasurable freedom, when we see that, allows us to have a wakeful response. It's the end of being bound to our greed, to our hatred and our delusion. The greed and the hatred and the delusion color consciousness and prevent us from seeing our freedom or being in touch with our freedom. The difference between a good day and a bad day is really how much greed, hatred, and delusion color consciousness. Equanimity is also one of the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings of the heart. So, the four immeasurable minds, or the divine abidings they're called, are, of course, love, which is metta, compassion, karuna, joy, mudita. So joy is this delightful joy that we have in the success of others, or deep appreciation. This is mudita. And the fourth is equanimity, subject of this talk. So the story goes, of course, that in India, a Brahmin man came to the Buddha and said, how can I be with God? How can I be with Brahma? And of course, the Buddha answered in a language that he could understand and said, if Brahma is the source of love, you can be with Brahma by practicing the four divine abidings, the four homes. Vihara means home. And of course, these four homes, the four things I just mentioned, they're the beautiful, formless qualities of the heart-mind that can inform life. They're an expression of our understanding of deep wisdom, but they're also to be cultivated in order to wake up. So here I'll tell you another story. This is about my son, Chris. Or my two sons, or two of my sons, actually. In 2019 in Australia, there were some very big fires. You probably heard about it. Places that had never burned before were alight. And one of those places was quite near where I used to live in a community, which I mentioned today, and where one of my sons at the time lived and build a beautiful house in the forest. At the time of the fire, I happened to be in America with a friend, and I sat bolt upright in bed one night and said, something has happened to my sons. Like I just knew it. I sat up. And of course, my partner grunted and said, go back to sleep. 0 points from me for that, by the way. And but it was exactly right. Something had happened to my sons. They were both okay. Happy ending story, okay? But my daughter-in-law sent me a text. The boys were chased out of the forest by the fire, but they're okay. That's all I knew. So when I arrived home, I immediately jumped on a plane when I saw how close the fires were to the houses of my friends and so many of my Dharma friends, and in particular two Dharma communities. The rainforest, that was virgin rainforest, was on fire. It is usually so wet one can't stand up. Slippery. The rocks are covered in slime, mold. It was alight. The minute I saw that picture on Facebook, posted by my daughter-in-law, I knew the trouble we were in. I knew the trouble we were in with climate change. It was already here, and devastation was coming. So I went home. It took me, you know, a day or two to get home. My sons then began to tell me what had happened. They had both been in, my twins, they're 45 years old now. They're both volunteer firefighters. In Australia, most of our firefighters are volunteer service. And they'd been in two separate trucks in the forest, fighting the fire in the place where they grew up. They were born in the rainforest. So they were very familiar with their surroundings and they knew the area. And the fire had begun to get out of control. They were making a big fire break, hoping to stop the fire. The fire started to sweep through the forest and a whole hillside exploded. We have eucalypt forests in Australia, and when there's enough heat and fire and wind, they simply explode. It's terrifying. So, of course, at that point, the fire chief radioed them, "Get out, get out, get out now." So they did, but they had to go up a long hill on a rough track to the top of the ridge and then right down the other side to the creek and out. My son Chris was in the first truck. They were not on a road, not a proper road. It was just an old logging trail through the forest. And he said to me, he said, "Mum, the fire was burning on both sides of the road. The road was alight." You can imagine, he's driving a fire truck through the flames, essentially, to get to a place where he knew he could reach safety. He was almost to safety, and he said, "Mum, I had to stop. I just had to stop." Incredible. He said, "I stopped, and I watered the wheels of the truck to stop them from melting." So they had water in the truck, luckily. So there he was, watering the wheels of the truck, watering the truck to stop it burning. So he's there with a couple of other friends. He needed to water the wheels of the truck because there was another truck coming behind. He said, "I had to keep the way open for those who came behind." In the truck behind was his twin brother and some other friends, one of my other sons, of course. It wasn't that he did that for 2 or 3 minutes. He was there for 20 minutes. So there he was. He said, "I knew I could get to safety myself." But he didn't think of himself. He saw really clearly what needed to be done. He said, "I had to keep the way open for the others who were further back." So in the face of death, really, in the face of death, not knowing what the outcome would be, he was really steady. This is equanimity. He was crystal clear about what needed doing. Water the wheels of the truck, keep the road open near the truck to make an escape route for those who are coming behind. Absolutely brilliant. So this is kind of natural equanimity. If I said to my son, Chris, you have equanimity, he'd say, what's that? He wouldn't have a clue. So there he was. The other truck did come and everybody was fine, but there wasn't even time to roll up the fire hoses. Chris said, cut the hoses. They just cut them and left them, jumped in the trucks and escaped. Everyone was safe. So this is equanimity. There's clear thought. It was fearless. He wasn't afraid. He just knew, he said, I just knew I had to stop. I knew what to do. I just waited. I knew my life could be saved, but he wasn't thinking of that. He was thinking of other people. So equanimity is selfless, not about me and mine and my life and my escape. So right there is an extraordinary example of fearlessness, equanimity, and selflessness. The selflessness is the immeasurable quality of the equanimity. This is what it is. It's this quality of heart. So I'm pretty proud of him. You can tell. He's a bit of a hero because he figured out a way to save all the houses. He had some pretty big aha moments. So don't we need to do this sometimes on the Dharma path? Don't we need to water the wheels and cool off a bit? Don't we need to cool the anger? Don't we need to water the wheels of our greed? And don't we need to keep the way open through insight and understanding for those who come behind? So those of us who teach the Dharma, keep the way open for the generations to come. So another friend of mine, and Dharma teacher, Martin Alwood from France, some of you may know him, prefers to translate the term upekkha as the vastness of the heart, a limitless embrace, an exquisite capacity to make room for anything and everything that arises in experience, to love what is, whether we like it or not. It's a good definition, I think. I'll read it again. It's the vastness of the heart, a limitless embrace, an exquisite capacity to make room for anything and everything that arises in experience. So this is the standing near to all things. To love what is, whether we like it or not. Just before I left Australia, I happened to be buying a coffee in a coffee shop. And there I saw an old friend of mine, someone who used to come to my meditation. His name's Asaf. And he was wearing a pressure bandage up one arm, the sort of bandages one wears when you've been burned. So I had heard that he had been very badly burned. He made a very near fatal mistake. He lives on a property, a farm, and he decided to burn off some logs and sticks and tree branches. But unfortunately, he decided to start the fire by pouring some petrol on the fire. Anyone who grows up in the countryside knows you never do that. And of course, what happened was the petrol exploded and he was very badly burned. He said he was wearing shorts. He said, rather, my face was completely black. His legs were burned and his arms were burned. He was saved a little by shorts and t-shirt. But the reason I'm telling the story is that his response was extraordinary. It was immediate. Of course, urgency in this situation. He's totally badly burned. He immediately ran for a phone, called his neighbour, said, I'm completely burned, I'll be in the pool, call an ambulance. So he said just the three things that he needed. He jumped in the swimming pool, stayed underwater for as long as he could. He'd come up for a breath and go under, waiting for the ambulance to come. The neighbour came immediately, of course, and to help him. The way he described the experience was extraordinary. He said, I didn't reject the experience. I didn't reject any part of it. He said, I gave it total attention, as you can imagine. You really badly burn, would keep your attention. So, he said he was in the pool, and he'd come up for air, and he'd go back under, and he said he began to get exhausted by doing this because he wasn't quite breathing enough. And so he and the friend decided he would stand under the shower, a cold shower, until the ambulance came, and they did that. Throughout the experience, he said, his mind was crystal clear. He said it was without thought. He said, I didn't think. There was no thought whatsoever. So there was no self-blame, no regrets, just the being with the experience totally, as it was, as it is. It was choiceless, really. There was nothing else he could have done. But the fact that he described it with such clarity and that he didn't have any thoughts. And he said, the clarity was sublime. He said, Radha, it was amazing. I can think of better experiences to call amazing. But this is an experience of, it's equanimity in the face of that which we ordinarily don't like. So it's to be with what is, whether we like it or not, whether it's pleasant or painful. This is our task. He said there was nothing additional in the experience other than that which was utterly necessary. Amazing. He was, of course, taken to hospital and taken care of. I asked him, did he experience a lot of pain? And he said the only time he felt pain was every few days when he was given a bath. He said because he had no skin, it was really, really painful to be cleaned and bathed. But it had to be done so that he didn't get an infection. So he said that was excruciatingly painful, and that he would shake and shiver, but he said he did his best just to be with the experience as much as possible, and he said in a few hours the trembling and shaking would subside. And so he said this was the only time that he was in an enormous amount of pain. At first, they said he'd need 5 surgeries. In the end, he had none. He was sent home. And his burns healed incredibly well. So this is equanimity in the face of a really unpleasant situation. Steadiness, clarity, nothing additional. Nothing we don't need with the mind. Clear thinking. Equanimity is also one of the absorptions. It's one of the deep states that we can reach in our meditation practice. It's one of the formless jhanas. It's the third jhana. So the first is inner happiness, the second, sublime joy, the third, equanimity, and the fourth, neither pleasure nor pain. These are states one can enter. And ironically, we enter the state of deep equanimity through equanimity. So we pay first attention to the breath. We stabilize the attention. We then shift the attention to the pleasant sensations that accompany the breath. We are very steady with the pleasant sensations that accompany the breath. We are steady with that without demanding anything else happens. And then what may happen is that focus deepens and we enter the very silent and beautiful sublime jhana of equanimity. Some of you will be able to enter that. Others may not. Actually, we don't need to be able to enter the deep states of concentration in order to wake up. That's the good news. But if you do have a mind that enables you to sit rather still, The depth of the sitting is delightful and it purifies the mind, it steadies the mind and consciousness. It's quite an extraordinary practice. And then as we come out of the very deep states, right there, as thought is returning and our ordinary sense of perception returns, right there is a really precious time to ask an inquiry question, to ask, what is this? Or what is consciousness? Or who am I? Or what is emptiness? There's countless inquiry questions that we can work with. And so that very moment when the sensitivity of the experience of the deep meditative state begins to fade, right there is the perfect spot for an inquiry question. And so we can place an inquiry question in our heart and then we just wait for the unfolding experience. And sometimes we can have rather delightful and deep and profound insights that emerge. Equanimity is also an awakening factor. So it's on many of the lists of the Buddha. So it wakes us up. It's to be practiced in order to awaken, and it's a natural expression of the awakened heart-mind. Now, since the retreat is ending tomorrow, I thought you might like to know some of the mental factors which, when cultivated, support equanimity in our daily life. So I'll just say them rather briefly. There's 7 of them. The first is integrity. So our actions, words, and deeds are based in sila, integrity. So as much as possible, our life is one of non-conflict and non-harming. In this way, our purity of heart develops. And consciousness is no longer coloured by ill will and self-centeredness. The second factor is faith. The Pali is Shraddha, so sometimes translated as confidence. It's a trust or a faith in our own capacity to understand, to practice, to have insights, to see into life. So we are committed to practice, and with the commitment, of course, comes intentions. And even if we meet our hindrances along the way, if we continue rather steadily, we can work through any hindrance that we meet. So this is trust in our capacity to cope with the difficult as well as the easy. The third is a well-developed mind. So we develop our concentration, our mental stability. So the practice simply of mindfulness of breathing develops our calmness, our steadiness, our mental stability. We're no longer thrown about as much by our moodiness or mind states. And of course, we're rather steady in the face of the dualities that Leela mentioned last night, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, and pleasure and pain. So these are the worldly conditions. The fourth is a sense of well-being. So of course this includes nourishing our body, taking care of ourselves. It also includes having an intention to live in peace and letting peace guide our actions. If we set the intention to live in peace, then a greater amount of contentedness arises. You saw in the instructions, when we just set the intention to breathe in and breathe out, experiencing contentedness, there it is. For many people, we can access it rather easily. So our intentions towards peace, our intentions to live in harmony are very important. And the Dalai Lama calls this spiritual development inner disarmament. And I think it's a great description of what we need to do. We need to disarm ourselves. We need to stop criticizing ourselves because it's so painful. Just reflecting on the first inquiry today. There's such pain with the inner judgment or the judgment that lands inwardly. And so if we cultivate a sense of well-being and kindness and friendliness towards ourselves, then those tendencies naturally fall away and we're released from the inner terrorist. So the fifth of the mental factors is wisdom and understanding. So, of course, this is what we've been doing all week, wisdom of not self, the wisdom of impermanence, the wisdom of non-clinging, Buddha wisdom, awakened wisdom, wisdom that comes through knowing our interconnectedness with all things, the wisdom of emptiness that I spoke about a couple of nights ago. And, of course, not forgetting the wisdom of relinquishment, of letting go. And from the text, just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, so a rock, big rock, doesn't move in the wind. Even so, neither visible forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor bodily impressions, neither the desired nor the undesired can cause such a one to waver. So the one who knows equanimity does not waver. Steadfast is their mind, gained is deliverance. And of course, the sixth mental factor is insight. Of course, that's what we've been doing all week, seeing into our direct experience. The seventh support for equanimity is freedom. So resting amid all things, clinging nowhere, we know our freedom. And finally, there's a passage in one of the texts, the Udana. The Udana is the inspired utterances of the Buddha. It's a beautiful passage, not easy to understand. I'll read it to you. It's called In Praise of Equanimity. For one who clings, motion exists. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. Where there is no motion, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming or going. Where no coming or going is, there is no arising or passing away. There is neither this world, nor a world beyond, nor a state between. This is the end of suffering. I want to hear the last verse again. I'll read it one more time. For one who clings, motion exists. The movement, motion exists. One who does not cling, there's no motion. Where there's no motion, there's stillness. Where there's stillness, there's no craving. Where no craving is, there's neither coming nor going. Where no coming or going is, there's neither arising nor passing away. There is neither this world nor a world beyond, nor a state between. Just this is the end of suffering. Let's sit for a few minutes together, resting into equanimity. May all beings cultivate equanimity. May all beings live selflessly. And may all beings keep the way open for those who come behind. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your practice.